This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Four former Minneapolis police officers have now been arrested and charged in the death of George Floyd. That comes after more than a week of nationwide protest over the killing of Floyd and other black Americans at the hands of police. So will those arrests change the dynamic of the protests? Well, joining Intersection to discuss the demonstrations, what led to them, and the response is Dr. Eric Smore, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Rollins College. Dr. Smore, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Pastor Roderick Zach of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries. Pastor Zach, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for the invitation, Matt.
And you can join the conversation by sending in your questions and comments on Twitter. Are you joining those demonstrations? Are you moved to act in other ways? We want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Let me start by asking what both of you are thinking about as you witness the protests across this country. Pastor Zach, what's going through your mind?
Well, it is in response to, unfortunately, unlawful, brazen, merciless, atrocious killings, the killing of George Floyd. And unfortunately, this in the first instance, maybe probably the most stark. Mm-hmm. But and, you know, so the protests are happening to bring attention to disparity, inequality, injustices, and just a historic problem that hasn't really been adequately dealt with yet. So I think it's highlighting things. Unfortunately, there are some players that are acting out, but protesters are not necessarily looters, you know, and looters are looters. Mm-hmm. And protesters are protesters, so hopefully, you know, we can get some handle on the criminality that's happening. But there's an outcry. Dr. Martin Luther King said that riot is the voice of the unheard, in essence. So I do understand it. I'm an African American male. I've been unfortunately harassed by the police myself, and so it's something that has to be done. And it's wonderful to see such a diverse crowd, you know, that whites and Hispanics and Asians and African-Americans. And it's just wonderful to see that happening. And I'm glad for that day that it's not, you know, us, to use the term, crying in the wilderness by ourselves, but more so there's a more united voice. The powers that be can be sensitive and hear beyond just the outward demonstration of anger and get to the source of the problems.
Dr. Eric Smore, what are you thinking about and thinking about, especially as you watch what's unfolding here in Central Florida across the nation over the last few weeks, and you know these protests have been growing in strength and they don't seem to be going away.
What's going through my mind is that African Americans have been the victims of police brutality and institutional oppression since the end of the Civil War. And many people, of course, thought that after the Civil Rights Movement, those things went away. But it turns out that police brutality has always been with us. It's just that after the Civil Rights Movement, the cameras went away. With the camcorders and the cell phones, we're able to record what's happening in black and brown communities and put it on social media like Facebook that didn't exist previously. Mm-hmm. And then with in-depth reporting, anybody can go onto the internet and see all of the institutional oppression that exists in our criminal justice system. So the first thing that's going through my mind is that this stuff has always been with us. It hasn't gone away. And the second thing that's going through my mind is that young people are demanding that we give them what we promised that we would give them, and that's a just society. And you see young people from all backgrounds demanding that we give them justice. And I think it's time that we stand up with them and demand of our politicians that they change the systems that have existed for a long time.
Here at WMFE, we've heard from a couple of listeners who draw comparisons between the demonstrations we're seeing now and the demonstrations that they took part in and witnessed in the 1960s. What do you make of that comparison, Dr. Smore?
Okay, so I want to do two things with respect to the comparison of the demonstrations now and the demonstrations from the 1960s. The first is the protesters have been keen to draw a distinction between themselves and the people who have caused property damage. And then, of course, news outlets have reported that there are outside people coming into the protest and causing property damage. We saw that same tactic with the civil rights movement. There were people who attempted to infiltrate Dr. King's civil rights movement and then caused property damage for the purpose of denigrating the movement. So that's the first comparison that I want to draw. The second comparison that I want to draw is that there's nothing new about people who don't have democratic outlets for change or whose politicians have ignored them for years engaging in protests. And some of our most celebrated protests, we find that the protest often leads to property damage. Mm-hmm. The Boston Tea Party is a story about property damage. When we look at the Hong Kong protesters, we find that there's been over $600 million in property damage. And so although the protesters today aren't engaged in that, there are people from the outside coming in, if people aren't paid attention to or if they don't have democratic means for making change, you will see their anger and frustration spill over into property damage.
Mm-hmm. Pastor Zach, your thoughts on the sort of comparisons between what we're seeing now and what we saw in the 60s?
Yeah, during the 60s, it was a more establishment-oriented, Christian-led movement. The whole process of mobilization was different. The focus on nonviolence was heavy, and there was even though it was still visceral, very folks still angry. They were trained and it was a process prior to participating in the march. Mm-hmm. Here, you know, you got the event of social media, this, you know, concise communication that they're making. It's more grassroots. There's no really definitive leader. So it's a stark difference. Hopefully some leaders, some definitive leaders will be birthed from this in terms of some spokespersons that can lead the way to the process of solutions, strategies, tactics, a whole paradigm shift, and that's what's being called for. So I'm hoping and praying that that will be the next steps in this. But right now we see grieving and just a kind of righteous indignation, bemoaning the injustice and the historical injustice. And coupled with the fact that we have a pandemic and huge numbers of people who are laid off, furloughed, terminated. So it's populated by, the last hired, the first fired, and those who are disenfranchised right now. So it's also, which shows for the huge numbers that we have here, have to do with people being somewhat displaced, which even is maybe a displaced anger in addition to the anger that people are experiencing as a result of the injustice. Mm-hmm. So you got numerous things happening simultaneously here.
It is pretty complicated, right? I mean, we are sort of at this unique sort of junction of events, and in some ways, it's hard to step back and take a look and say, How do we get through this? I want to just throw out the Twitter handle again if you want to comment on the show. We are speaking with Pastor Roderick Zach and Dr. Eric Smore talking about police brutality and the events leading up to the protests, the death of George Floyd, and what may come out of these protests. Brandon writes in, make sure that you say the looters / violence isn't affiliated with the BLM protests, the Black Lives Matter protests. The looters are taking advantage of this time, but I also agree with John F. Kennedy. When peaceful revolution is ignored, violent revolution is inevitable. And I think that speaks a little bit, Pastor Zach, to what you were saying about the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And one more comment here from Brandon. Our national anthem ends with the lyrics, "The land of the free and the home of the brave." When that first part isn't true, that second part needs to be. I believe there are actually some verses of the national anthem which we don't typically sing, which may say some other things as well. But I take your point. Thanks for writing in, Brandon. Eric Smore, I just wonder, sort of, is this a moment where we all really need to sort of take a step and sort of reflect and say, okay, how do we get to this point?
Okay, so this is an excellent question. I want to take us back to 2006. The FBI published a report called the Intelligence Assessment Report, in which they told us that white supremacists have infiltrated our police departments in many cities throughout the country. This fact was reconfirmed by the Department of Homeland Security in a report called the Joint Intelligence Report. The Ku Klux Klan called their members who have infiltrated policing departments ghost Klansmen because they hold all of the traditional beliefs of Ku Klux Klansmen, but they don't act in traditional ways. So, for example, they don't wear the sheets and they don't use typical racist language. I call these people asymptomatic racists. At the extreme end of asymptomatic racism, you'll have Ku Klux Klansmen who have infiltrated policing departments, and that's where you get this brutalization of African Americans and Hispanic Americans in many cities throughout the country. You also get false arrests and unwarranted convictions of people, and hopefully I'll have a chance to talk about that later. But at the end of asymptomatic racism, you get people like Amy Cooper, who calls the police on Christian Cooper and issues a false report about him in Central Park. So to the question of how did we get here, there has been a process of moving, or at least a process from the Ku Klux Klansmen, of moving their members out of sheets and into policing departments so that they can act under the color of law. And even when they do things like we saw in Minnesota with George Floyd, they get the protection of qualified immunity, and therefore they don't end up in jail under most conditions.
Just sort of thinking about some of your comments there, Dr. Smore, I wonder how you sort of balance that with, you know, what we've seen, you know, just thinking about here in Central Florida, but I think across the country as well. I mean, a lot of police chiefs and sheriffs have come out and said pretty emphatically, you know, what happened to George Floyd was wrong. It was a crime. It should be prosecuted. The people who perpetrated it should be prosecuted. So how do you sort of balance those two things when you're talking about, you know, what you're calling the extreme end of asymptomatic racism, which is, you're saying, is kind of baked into some police departments? Like, how do those two things kind of measure up for you?
That's right.
Dr. Smore, if you wouldn't mind.
Go ahead.
Okay, that's right. It's not true that all police officers are racist, and it's most certainly not true that all police captains or all European Americans are racist. So, of course, there are many police officers who go to work every day, they do their jobs, and they try to do their jobs well. But on January 6th in 2015, the House of Representatives passed what's called H.R. 46. Mm-hmm. H.R. 46 tells us that in states like Texas, Kentucky, Alabama, Arkansas, and many other states, police officers were engaged in false arrests of African-American males. And then to ensure convictions, they would falsify evidence, fabricate evidence, intimidate witnesses, and so on. Those wrongful convictions have occurred all throughout this country. Now, most Americans will hear this and say, this is outrageous behavior. It most certainly can't be true. But when we look at exoneration statistics, we find that 60% of people who are exonerated for sexual assaults are African American, and 50% of people who are exonerated for murder are African American, and 55% of people who are exonerated for drug possession are African American. So we know that African Americans are being falsely arrested and wrongfully convicted at much higher rates than everyone else. But notice, no police officers go to jail for this. No prosecutors lose their job for this because of what I mentioned before, and that's qualified immunity. In fact, the movie Just Mercy gave us an excellent example of how this occurs.
Let me just come to you real quick, Pastor Zach, before we go to a break, and your thoughts on the notion of what Dr. Smore is referring to as asymptomatic racism and sort of how far embedded that is into some of these institutions.
Unfortunately, the design of the fraternal order, you know, of police, in other words, it's a type of fraternity, and unfortunately, they do protect each other. They you know, and you can understand why. But by the same token, there has to be more than just a self review, self examination, self diagnosis in order to remedy the problem. There has to be a broader view. And unfortunately, the United States has been in the process of historically dehumanization of African Americans in a lot of ways, unfortunately, and we still see it, even in comments that that are made from public officials. And so, this dehumanization is a national crisis that can't be ignored any longer. There has to be value given to all life. And it's played out in a lot of different ways. The stereotypical depiction of African Americans as predominantly criminal, as predominantly uneducated, as predominantly violent, so forth and so on. So there's just this automatic predisposition in terms of what we're capable of, and so that has to be broken down. There has to be a renewed re-education and so forth to alleviate that. And the church needs to jump in. The predominantly white church needs to jump in and become moral brokers of what's right. Racism is not political. It's just wrong. It's immoral. And for them to be so silent and to say, in some instances, very little about racism and injustice and things of that nature, to be, in essence, Christian, politically correct in a Christian sense, it starts with them becoming a moral compass along with other institutions and agencies and so forth. It starts with that mindset being crushed.
More to talk about on the other side of this break. Do stay with us. Pastor Roderick Zach of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries and Eric Smore, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Rollins College. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're discussing police brutality and racism, the nationwide demonstrations, and the response to those demonstrations with Dr. Eric Smore from Rollins College and Pastor Roderick Zach of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries. You can join the conversation by tweeting us your questions to @WMFEOrlando. Jennifer writes in, "Let's be clear also that although protesters during the civil rights movement were nonviolent, it was a technique to provoke responses to demonstrate the violence of white supremacy." Pastor Zach, your thoughts on that? Does it seem like we're seeing some of that echoed now in these protests and these demonstrations?
You mean the infiltration? I'm sorry, could you rephrase the question?
So just to Jennifer's point about the fact that protesters during the civil rights movement were nonviolent, that was a technique to provoke responses to demonstrate the violence of white supremacy. I'm just wondering if there's some echoes in the, you know, what the civil rights protesters were aiming for in the 60s and what we're seeing
now. The protesters during the 60s, they had to be taught how to respond to violence against them. You know, so that's you know, unfortunately, we see in our own police officers disproportionately respond to these protesters, you know, with a full, you know, army gear and tear gas and concussion the type of bombs. I'm not sure the title, but well, we see it all over the news. And a softer, a different approach is what's needed right now. And these young people haven't been trained in terms of how to respond. I see them getting down on their knees periodically or laying down. So that means some of them haven't. But there was a full regiment of instruction prior to going on a march. I went on a march in 1968, mm-hmm. and I was a young man, and we received a full regiment of instruction prior to going on a march. And that's hit and miss with these protesters.
Here's another question from a listener. This kind of speaks to what we're talking about right now. At IW Mango, thanks for writing in. It writes, what are your opinions on the #8CantWait policies, considering the history of the police? Is such policy just putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, so to speak? And I'm just looking at their website now, 8CantWait. There are, according to this website, 8 policies that could decrease police violence by 72%. Some of those things are ban chokeholds and strangleholds, require de-escalation, require warning before shooting, exhaust all other means before shooting, and 4 others as well. So let me put that question to you, Eric Smore. Are you familiar with this push and some of the policies therein?
Yes, I am. I am. And I think that there are 2 types of changes we can make. Some of the changes are bold, and some of the changes are standard. So I'll start with the bold changes because I want to get those in. So, look, in 1967, the Supreme Court passed a doctrine called qualified immunity. Basically, what that means is that a police officer can be held liable for abusing you only if there is clearly established law against that abuse at the time in which it occurs. What this means is that if I get brutalized by a police officer, I have to look back into history to find a case with similar circumstances in which a police officer was prosecuted. Well, we can see that there are going to be 2 problems here. First, in the 1960s, police officers were not being prosecuted for brutalizing African Americans, so we're not going to have those cases established. Mm-hmm. But even if I can find a case, all a judge has to say is, well, the circumstances aren't similar. And though I recognize that your constitutional rights were violated, because I cannot meet the Supreme Court standard of clearly established law, you lose. And this, of course, has allowed police officers to act with impunity. So what can we do? The first thing all of us must do is write all of our congressmen and men and women and tell them to abolish qualified immunity, because it allows police officers to act with impunity. And then we need to establish a necessary standard. The necessary standard tells us some of the things that the people at Hate Can't Wait want. First, police officers must exhaust other remedies before they can act with violence. So no chokeholds, they have to look to de-escalate, and so on. Mm-hmm. A second thing that we could do is require a broad reading of the Fourth Amendment. Because the Supreme Court has so restricted the Fourth Amendment, that's also given police officers impunity to do what they will with us, and the Fourth Amendment can't protect us. So we need a broad reading of the Fourth Amendment. Those 2 things will take us a long way, in addition to things like banning chokeholds. So those are the broad changes I would argue for.
Yeah, and just to refresh the memory of our listeners and myself too, to be honest, the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated. Some work to be done from the point of view of reform there. I want to get to another question and come back to something you were talking about before the break, Pastor Zach, and the role of the faith community in all of this as we sort of look to the future beyond these demonstrations. And I understand you're going to be walking tomorrow morning, Friday morning, as part of a walk of mourning and restoration. Talk to me a little bit about the walk and the purpose of it.
Well, the purpose of the walk is to in essence, grieve, to experience remorse, to lament, to think about the loss. And I think 400 names of persons who've been killed by police will be read off along with scriptures that talk about mourning, grieving. And then there'll be some apologies. Well, there'll be a testimony from some folks who have been abused. And then there'll be some apologies issued in terms of showing remorse by law enforcement, by predominantly white religious leaders, to just say, hey, we could have done more. We could have been more sensitive. We could have instructed more. We could have not been insensitive to this issue in the past and making a commitment to do better in the future. So prior to instituting action plans, strategies, considering best practices for reformation of the judicial system, of the criminal justice system, just taking a minute to feel this, to empathize, and that's what we do as a community. We mourn with those who mourn. We weep with those who weep, and then we get up from there, you know, like a funeral, and from there we go forward and trying to strategize where we go from here. So it's a precursor to strategies for change.
Mm-hmm. And so just so I'm clear, you will be walking alongside members of law enforcement who will be sort of part of that process as well?
That's true. Christian leaders, judges, you know, state's attorney, others are coming out to join us, along with a diverse cadre of Christian leaders, mm-hmm. both white and African-American and Hispanic.
This is obviously part of a long process, but what do you see going forward? Like, what do you think the next few months looks like, if it's even possible to sort of see that far out at this point?
Well, I think some think tanks are already developing that has some major people involved in developing like a task force that considers this from in a comprehensive way. And to innovate, to be creative in how we look at policing, and first try to analyze and take best practices and implement those, but also think about different ways that we can. For instance, we can electronically issue a ticket. Is it a way that we can? Some of our officers in our church said the most fearful experience they have is when they approach a vehicle. Is there a way that we can mitigate that? Is there a way that we can minimize approaching vehicles? You know, it can't be apprehension at any cost. You know, so is there a value system in the police system that says, okay, if you have a blank incident where you don't make an apprehension, do you get penalized for that? So how can we do policing that's more investigative, that's more more involved in, waiting sometimes as opposed to jumping right in if it's a nonviolent scenario. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that have to be considered. And voices and thinkers and sociologists and psychologists, have to come in and help the police department come up with a new paradigm, a new model that's more than them adjusting themselves. Mm-hmm. And hopefully government authorities will be involved in that, because they're supposed to be the overseers, and it's going to take some legislation, but it's going to take some local action, regional action to make a difference. And that's what we're going for in Orange County and the counties surrounding us in the Central Florida area.
In the last minute or so, and I'm afraid we're kind of running out of time here, but Dr. Eric Smore, where do you see this conversation heading in the next month or so?
It's difficult to tell exactly where it'll go because there are so many things going on at one time. So we have the protests going on, we have high rates of unemployment, and we also have COVID-19 still ongoing.
Right.
One thing that's true is that we don't have national leadership on this issue. So what I hope is that we'll have national leadership. I think that every single American can get out and vote at the national level, at the state level, and at local levels. And we can also require that our colleges and universities, our middle schools, elementary schools, and high schools teach American history that encompasses all people in America, and teach it openly and teach it honestly. Finally, the thing that I would add is that we can understand our protests for what they really are. They're cries out from the people for justice. Mm-hmm. And so while I don't expect my protesters to be perfect, I do expect their causes to be just. And if we can celebrate the justice in the civil rights movement, we can celebrate the justice now.
And we're going to have to leave it there, but I've been speaking with Dr. Eric Smore from Rollins College and Pastor Roderick Zack of Rejoice in the Lord Ministries. I want to thank you very much both for joining us. And coming up next, coronavirus and hurricane season. We'll talk about how emergency managers are preparing and how Puerto Rico is bracing for an active season. That's when we return. Do stay with us. Thank you. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. It's the first week of hurricane season. Already, Tropical Storm Cristobal is expected to head for the US through the Gulf later this week. So what are the challenges of preparing for hurricane season with the country still in the grip of the coronavirus pandemic? Later in the show, we'll talk with Fernando Rivera, director of UCF's Puerto Rican Research Hub, about how Puerto Rico is bracing for hurricane season, even as the effects of Hurricane Maria linger on nearly 3 years later. But first, environmental reporters Amy Green and James Bruggers join Intersection to talk about their collaborative reporting for Inside Climate News and NPR on the challenge of potentially coping with two disasters at once. Joining me are 90.7 environmental reporter Amy Green. Thanks for being here, Amy.
Nice to be here.
We're also joined by James Bruggers. He is a reporter for Inside Climate News covering the southeastern United States. James, thanks as well for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So both of you have collaborated on a piece of reporting about the unique circumstances we are at the start of the hurricane season, where emergency managers are contemplating a pretty active season and thinking about how to cope with this pandemic. James, I wonder if you could sort of start us off. What was the genesis of the story?
Oh, I think it's just sort of, we were all, I mean, everybody's been living in the middle of this, you know, coronavirus situation, and we've been watching our emergency managers deal with that. We've been watching, just regular people deal with that and the fear and the concern and these stay inside, stay safe at home type of situations that we've been hearing from our governors. And then all of a sudden, you know, you look up and it's June 1st is approaching, and you're reminded of, you know, sometimes people have to get out and evacuate by the millions. And so, how are they going to do shelters? How are you going to pack all these people in shelters when they're supposed to social distance? It was an obvious clash that we wanted to look at.
Mm-hmm. Amy, in talking with people who study this stuff and are experts in the field, what have they said? I mean, what is the kind of threat level or the fear level amongst emergency managers who are, you know, typically able to take a pretty pragmatic view of things like hurricanes and emergencies?
Well, I think what we're looking here is the potential for two disasters. Hopefully we don't have a hurricane. Let's just put that right out there up front. But we're looking at the potential of two disasters layered right on top of the other. You know, the destruction of a hurricane, the powerful winds, the flooding, the storm surge, layered on top of, you know, this, you know, already, you know, this crisis that already is happening with this historic pandemic. And some of the biggest worries with that is, you know, this very fundamental confusion over whether we should keep sheltering in place, which is the messaging that we've been hearing from our leaders now since the middle of March, contrasted against, you know, what many Floridians have always done during hurricanes, which is evacuate. So that's maybe the biggest question that leaders are weighing at this point. There's all kinds of worries and complications when you take the evacuation issue by itself. You know, people may feel confused, you know, look, do I evacuate and potentially expose myself to a dangerous disease, or do I stay at home and potentially expose myself to, you know, the destruction of a hurricane? Add to that, there may be many people who've lost their jobs and they might not be able to afford to evacuate.
Mm-hmm. James, have some themes come to the surface when you talk to emergency managers about how they balance those two things, the competing needs of evacuation versus sheltering in place?
One of the interesting things that came up in my talks, in my interviews, I think we're going to be seeing decisions made, calls made on who to evacuate, where to evacuate, when to evacuate, that are going to be perhaps, those discussions are going to be maybe more well thought out than in the past, or at least thought out in a different way, because I was told that there was a tendency in the past to over evacuate, to be on the safe side, but now they'll be looking, and if there's areas that are where it's newer housing and stronger homes and a higher ground, they'll tell people to stay where they are. They certainly are going to always get people out of places where they think are going to flood, because, you know, the floodwaters, storm surges, the water is what really kills. But they're going to be a little more careful, perhaps, about the calls that they make because they know that they don't want to overwhelm, you know, a shelter system.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard is that emergency managers in Miami, for example, were discussing using public schools to shelter in. I mean, some of them are shelters anyway in hurricanes, but they would be opening up more classrooms so they could get a little more space between people. Is that something that you're seeing as well, or something that you're hearing about?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that we are going to see this hurricane season is leaders really re-examining that concept of evacuating. And as Jim said, really looking at when and where is that necessary. And one thing that we heard from Jared Moskowitz on a conference call is, you know, one thing they're looking at is shelter in place orders, especially in areas where houses are newer, they're sturdier, and they're built to hurricane codes, keeping those people at home. We may also hear from leaders messaging, advising people if they need to evacuate, people don't need to go to Georgia. They can evacuate and stay close by. Mm-hmm. And then in places where people need to evacuate, rather than sheltering people together in large groups in school gymnasiums, as we've seen in the past, as Floridians are very familiar with, seeing those people sheltered instead in hotels and motels that have been left vacant by the economic lulls.
You know, here in Florida, we've had a couple of powerful storms roll through in recent years, and communities are still rebuilding. Like in the panhandle from Hurricane Michael, there's still kind of federal money coming through to some of those communities that were impacted by hurricanes. And I'm wondering, too, if that poses a challenge for emergency management systems, emergency managers, where some of their resources may have been tapped out a little bit by the pandemic as well.
You know, I did speak with Craig Fugate, former leader of the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Florida counterpart, and I think he did speak to that. And I think one of the things he said is, you know, as you said, Matt, a lot of those payments are still being processed years later. One thing that we could see happen should we get a hurricane this season, because FEMA is so stretched as it is, and because state emergency management leaders are so stretched as it is with the coronavirus crisis, that we could see emergency management workers be taken off some of those, you know, lingering paperwork issues from hurricanes past and redirected into more current situations.
Could I just add something to that, which is sort of relevant? I mean, oceans, you know, because of global warming, oceans are kind of brewing up these bigger storms more often. There's new science in this that came out just this month. And, you know, they supply, the oceans supply the energy for the storms. The warmer atmosphere means more moisture. And higher sea levels means higher sea levels and more moisture in the atmosphere increases flooding from storm surges and rain. So these bigger storms are coming more frequently, and the science is now starting to document that. And so it's really a situation that I think we kind of all have to be ready for now, still recovering from one storm when another storm happens to come through, because the recovery takes a long time.
Well, finally, James and Amy, I just wanted to ask what's kind of in the pipeline for both of you and for Inside Climate News in this partnership as far as reporting. Like, you know, hurricane season is going to potentially be quite busy, but do you have some other projects in the hopper that you're looking forward to reporting on, or some threads that you're following? Amy, what about you for a start?
Well, this will be a story we'll be following. Every major forecasting organization is predicting above average activity this hurricane season. NOAA is predicting 6 to 10 hurricanes. And so we'll be watching that story closely.
This collaboration is part of Inside Climate News' National Environmental Reporting Network. And Amy and I met each other at a workshop in Nashville a while back. And there was a joint project that we did with a number of other newsrooms around the Southeast. And I know Amy and I have talked about looking at environmental politics and climate politics in the upcoming election. So it's possible we might collaborate around that, but we're definitely open to ideas and suggestions and ways to work together.
Well, James Bruggers is a reporter for Inside Climate News. He covers the southeastern United States. James, thanks so much for being here.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We're also joined by 90.7's environmental reporter, Amy Green. Amy, thanks as well.
Thanks for having me.
And both James and Amy reported on the start of hurricane season and the pandemic and how emergency managers are planning for that. And you can find that story on our website, wmfe.org. While it's expected to be an active hurricane season, some communities are still repairing from storms years later, including Puerto Rico, which was devastated by Hurricane Maria in 2017. To get a sense of how Puerto Rico is bracing for hurricane season during the pandemic, I talked to Fernando Rivera. Fernando Rivera is a professor of sociology at the University of Central Florida, and he leads the Puerto Rican Research Hub. Fernando, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Let's think about hurricane season for a moment. And we are in the middle of a global pandemic. We are approaching what's predicted to be a more busy than average hurricane season, more activity in the Atlantic. Thinking about Puerto Rico and the unique situation that the island is in the eye of some pretty vicious storms, or it has been in the past, what's going through your mind as far as where we are now in terms of preparation and maybe where we need to be?
Well, absolutely. It's concerning. Obviously, like 2 years ago, we had to deal with Hurricane Maria, and so the focus was hurricanes. But the reality at the beginning of this year was that we have to deal with earthquakes and continuous seismic movement. And not only earthquakes, but also tsunamis that are attributed to earthquakes. And on top of that, we have COVID-19 and the pandemic. And how do you prepare for those? So that's putting a lot of stressors and challenges to the emergency management in Puerto Rico. You know, there's hopeful signs, right? After Hurricane Maria, you know, plans have been established. Just right now, the National Guard is doing an exercise to really test the system and see where the cracks, what lessons can be learned. So that's a positive aspect. But at the same time, you have the pandemic going on. So what are you going to do with shelters? What are you going to do in terms of the resources that I needed? You know, in terms of, you know, if you think about Hurricane Maria, you know, Florida sort of became sort of that helping aid for the island when everything shut down. But would that be even a possibility if we're still on lockdown and still there's going to be restrictions in terms of how do you deal with those logistic in terms of, you know, transmitting the COVID-19 virus as well? So there's a lot of challenges ahead. So it's a very scary proposition looking into the summer.
I feel like we haven't heard a lot on the mainland United States about how Puerto Rico is coping with the pandemic. What are you hearing?
Well, the measures that the governor took in place is more restrictive than it is here. It's slowly opening up. There was some issues with, you know, the head of the Department of Health. I think we went through three of them in a span of maybe a month in the beginning of the pandemic. It seems that overall it's been contained, but you know, as usual, you know, we're dealing with the issue of tests, just like in the United States, and you know, in terms of do we have enough kids out there? There was a little bit of controversy about the way the initial tests that were bought for an outrageous amount of money with contracts that were deemed to be a little bit shady. So that kind of like set up the response for it. And there was the issue of controversy of opening school lunches for public school kids that might not have sources of food out there. Then sort of the CARES Act did actually reach Puerto Rico, but it took a little bit longer since they gave the money to sort of the agencies out there that they had to put a sort of a plan together. It had to be approved by the Treasury Department in the United States. So that took a while out here. And still there are some people still waiting for that initial help from the federal government. There's been some help provided by the local government of Puerto Rico. But it seems that, you know, it's been a slow process. But in terms of death and the information that we have, not as severe as people expected.
Fernando, what are you hearing about how people in Puerto Rico are responding to some of the restrictions too? Because here in the mainland United States, there has been some pretty vocal pushback to some of the more strict measures of social distancing, some pretty loud calls to reopen things sooner than a lot of local authorities would like. Are you seeing some of that mirrored in Puerto Rico as well?
Not to the level that is here. I think people are sort of afraid of the virus, and you know, actually, police was giving out fines and arresting people if they didn't comply. So there was kind of like a stronghold that people kind of like stay in place in terms of that. I think in Puerto Rico, my sense is that taking it a little bit more seriously than we are here in terms of that, and obviously. You know, Hispanics and African Americans seem to be more at risk than other groups. So I think that there's that kind of like that idea. So a lot of people, it seems, are complying with at least a mask and all sort of stuff. But as we see the restrictions, we're going to see if that's going to continue or not, and whether we're going to see sort of an increase in the number of cases.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. My guest is Fernando Rivera, professor of sociology at the University of Central Florida. We've talked in the past too, Fernando, about the political situation in Puerto Rico and how some of the kind of political fractures there, or some of the issues that Puerto Ricans feel, you know, maybe let down by their government, those have been exacerbated by things like hurricanes and earthquakes, right? I mean, we saw the former governor pretty much ousted over his handling of some of those crises. Has the pandemic shone a similar spotlight on some of the political fractures in Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, so like we were talking at the beginning, you know, so there was when the pandemic was about to hit, there was an investigation about the supplies that were kept in a warehouse in the southern part of Puerto Rico. The allegation was that it was going to be distributed based on political affiliation. So there was an investigation going on. And for a lot of people, it seems like, you know, great timing to put people and don't let people protest and do certain things out here. So the political machine is still going out there. In Puerto Rico, there's a new civil code that's been very controversial in terms of some of the things that have been included without having the public actually put a lot of input into it. There's an electoral reform that is going on as well, where voting is going to be online. So there's issue of fraud for the next upcoming elections, again, without any input from the public or the right to actually going to the hearings and all sort of things. And the big one was that, you know, they yet are going to have another referendum on the status of the island. And that put people in a surprise sort of situation, right, in terms of, you know, really right now in this pandemic, this is what we're going to do for November 3rd. And mm-hmm. that was fast track out here. And this time around, it's going to be just one question, whether you want statehood or not.
Now, just getting back to hurricane season, what's going through your mind as you anticipate this upcoming season? Like, where do you think the pressure points are going to come if a big storm does hit Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, knowing about the infrastructure is not up to par still. You know, projects are still being funded for bridges and roads and all sort of things.
What about the power grid?
The power grid was kind of like patch up, put together, but not necessarily up to date. That's been sort of the frustration of a lot of people in Puerto Rico that, you know, when you have a thunderstorm on some type of weather event, the electricity actually goes out. So it's not up to par. I don't think it would hold, you know, a major, major hurricane out here. I think that for me, the big issue is, you know, what's going to happen if a repetition of Maria actually happens. I'm a little bit hopeful this time around because there's been some plans that are put in place. There's been some exercises put together. And I think even communities are more prepared than they were the first time around. Mm-hmm. But with that said, you know, we're still in the pandemic type of phase. So just the sort of the idea of having a pandemic and going to a shelter or not, or trying to survive this when you say stay at home and there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no communications, you know, that will be a nightmare scenario. So I think, you know, the emergency management agencies are doing the best that they can right now to prepare for that. But realistically, it's going to, if it hits, it's going to take a big toll on the future of the island.
Well, Fernando Rivera heads up UCF's Puerto Rican Research Hub. Thanks so much again, Fernando.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, production assistants for this week's show from Juan Gualda and Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. That service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit WMFE.org to make your contribution, and thanks. Check out our Facebook Live show, The State We're In, produced in partnership with WUSF in Tampa. Next Tuesday, we'll continue the conversation about protest and activism. Tune in at facebook.com/State We're In. Follow us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando, and I'm at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.